Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, we're going to begin the day with Professor Oren M. Levin-Waldman, and we're going to be discussing his essay, the most recent essay, which is The Real Casualty of Rising Income Inequality is the Middle Class. Before we begin, of course, if you're not familiar with the professor, he's a faculty member in the School of Public Affairs and Administration at Rutgers University in Newark and socioeconomic research scholar at the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity Research. You can learn more about him at his own website, which is www.econlabor.com. So that's www.econlabor.com. And on his website, you could also find out how to reach out to him and ask him questions, or just engage in some of, or even buying the books that he's written, which are terrific. So bear with me a moment here. I think I need to do one thing to get the professor back, and there's too much happening on the website. Bear with me a second. Okay, we're going to get there. I know we're going to get there. sometimes it goes crazy. You know, I think I've got to, personally, I think I've got to just reduce all this stuff that happens on the site. Okay. Well, here we are. Good morning, Professor. What a pleasure to have you on today. I hope you're well.
Good morning.
Well, good morning. Well, this is a chock full, very heavy dissertation in your essay about what's going on. And the real casualty of rising income inequality is the middle class. And I've always wondered why it never seemed to stick. Mentally, it doesn't seem to really conform to people's mindset. Why is it that we don't understand the middle class? We always talk about the poor and we talk about the wealthy. And the middle class seems to be squeezed out of the equation. And is that really the beginning of the problems that we're looking at today?
Well, it's certainly a symptom of the problems that we have today. But, you know, the middle class has been squeezed out for quite some time now, and nobody has really paid attention to the impact of the middle class. The narrative has basically been on the impact of the poor and not necessarily on the middle class, partly, at least in the current climate. If you say middle class, then you must obviously mean white middle class. And you might even mean the white middle class with grievances, those people who voted for Trump. So you're not really focusing on the middle class. You're focusing on the poor. And if you focus on the poor, then you can say, okay, the solution is really simple. Just redistribute income and wealth from the wealthy to the poor, and then everybody will be happy. But it doesn't really quite work that way, and quite frankly, the nature of income inequality is such that its impact is that politicians are even less likely to listen to anybody whose income falls below a certain threshold, in which case they'll be totally non-responsive, in which case the old model of redistribution no longer will hold.
Well, I think it was in Nevada today, I think it was Nevada, where the old guard of Democrats and Republicans literally was when the progressive Democrats won the day. Why is that particular narrative so important for people and their thinking that voting for redistribution is going to be a benefit to them? And I think you point out in your article very, very succinctly that, the benefits that they throw out at people is not the issue, and that they need to get a bigger salary, which they didn't get. So they need the money. They don't need the programs. So how do we resolve that?
Well, I mean, I suppose the simplest solution is to get different politicians in office, but that's not, that may be wishful thinking, and that's not going to quite happen. And maybe there's an education campaign here as well, that people just don't really understand the nature of the data that's being presented to them. But, you know, when you talk about rising income inequality, or at least the rate of increase in income inequality, what you are really talking about is the disappearance of the middle class. And nobody really sees it that way. They just see it as a war between the top and the bottom. But it's more than that. It may be that that's true, but it's, what it signifies is the disappearance of the middle class. Because in order for a good, solid democracy to survive, you need to have a robust middle class. So you won't have that tension between the top and the bottom. You don't want to have a social strife. You don't want to have a threat from within where one class seeks to usurp the other class, and basically it could lead to some kind of violent revolution. But, you know, again, the solution has been, well, if you think that there's a social strife on the horizon, simply throw some more money at the problem in the form of redistribution. And I think we're seeing that right now with the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. Well, we don't know exactly what to do, so we'll just throw money at the problem.
And so. We're really not focusing on the middle class, but can we ever get to the point where we could focus on the middle class? Because you also point out in your essay that the well-to-do are and those in power are only listening to the people who send the money, because they're involved in politics. They want to stay in power, so they serve them at the highest end. They throw a bone to the people at the lower end. If people at the lowest end get an increase in salary, will that increase the earning power and political power of the middle class? Is that the way it's supposed to work?
It should work that way. If you have policies in place to lift the incomes of even those at the bottom, it will ultimately affect the incomes of those in the middle. So a rising tide will lift all ships. Maybe progressives don't really want a rising tide to lift all ships. They just want to be targeted in those ships that they lift, because they figured there's some political payback for them. I think, again, we're seeing that. If you look at, do a serious analysis of data, let's say wage data, using the Census Bureau as a source of that data, if you look at it and from the last few years, what you will note is, and it can stare you right in the face, median incomes for white workers have declined. Median incomes for black workers and Latino workers have increased. Now, there's a couple of ways to interpret that. One is to say, well, if that's true, then what's all this talk about systemic racism in the labor market? And if there's no systemic racism, then the narrative that was presented during the 2020 election was simply false. Now, if that's true, it was false, then this focus on a narrative basically means you don't have to pay attention to serious economic issues. But it also means that the Republican Party, in not presenting this data, basically committed what we could call campaign malpractice. Basically, they had an argument to make that could have made, but instead they focus on the Trumpian, well, the economy is just fabulous, the economy is wonderful, we're so wonderful, we're perfect. But they should have done better. But the other way to look at it, and this is where the progressives will basically, this is what they will focus on, is to simply say, look, yes, they have made gains over the last few years, but at the end of the day, guess what? White workers are still earning more than black workers. and they're earning more than Latino workers. So therefore, there must be something going on in the labor market. Now, that doesn't tell you a whole story. I mean, it doesn't tell you, if you simply look at whole groups in terms of their wages, it doesn't tell you what percentage of those groups are involved in specific occupations and what those occupations pay relative to other occupations and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't talk about the choices that people make. It doesn't tell you about the educational levels of attainment they have. So indeed, all these are factors that have to be figured into it. Now, if you actually break it down, and you know, you could say, well, now, as if you look at specific groups, white workers with advanced degrees versus black workers with advanced degrees, in, you know, say, professional managerial occupations, what you'll find is the percentage of black workers' pay relative to white. Again, white workers are still earning more, but they're earning. Black workers are earning a higher percentage of what white workers are. In other words, the gap is narrowing. If you actually look at the bottom of the labor market, the low-wage labor market, there's absolutely no difference between black, white, and Latino workers in terms of their median income.
So how is it that black and white are coming closer together in earning power, in the middle class? So how are they benefiting? What was in that?
The middle class is not necessarily benefiting. But again, when the work, the pay of the middle class, income inequality has dropped among certain groups because the pay at the bottom of the scale has increased more proportionally to relative to the pay of those at the top of the scale. But, you know, but again, we've also had this issue of white workers' pay has dropped. And as to why that's the case, it's not entirely clear. We'd have to have a closer look at that. But I mean, the data is not going to tell you the why.
I see. Okay. So the white workers' salary has been reduced somehow, or earnings has been reduced, which brings them closer to the black worker who may be getting a small increase. So, but then everyone in that whole field is losing money. Or it's not earning very much.
Well, again, among certain groups, what occurred was, like, you know, the median annual wages of black workers increased by, you know, 6-something percent, and the median income of white workers decreased by, you know, a couple percentage points. So there actually were real gains for minority workers, and there were losses for white workers. Now, if you're going to say, but see, there's still systemic racism in the labor market, is that true? I mean, you can interpret data any way you want to, I suppose.
Right.
And different groups will to make their political point. Data is manipulated by those who have an agenda that they want to present. But, you know, what you can say is the data that you have, you present, they do represent to a certain extent a fact or facts on the ground. The question is how you interpret them.
Well, I got to ask you then, are the progressives, you know, the Ocasio-Cortez and other people like her, the bottom line is, are they changing anything, or is it just rhetoric? Is it only rhetoric that we hear from them? You know, supposedly she wants to serve the those that have been are never empowered, and what is she doing, and can she do anything even as an elected official to change the equation, other than, for example, passing a $15 minimum wage, which hasn't come about?
So she can't even do that. The reality is a member of Congress, a sole member of Congress, really has limited power to do much of anything. And unless this member of Congress can forge an alliance with other members and basically create enough support or consensus for a particular program, they basically are limited in what they can do. But she's become a symbol for the progressive cause, if you want to call it that, and she's become a symbol for a more socialist vision of society, a vision not necessarily shared by most people or most of the population of the country. So, but, you know, she... One thing you can say about her is she's not your typical politician who bends according to shifting political winds. She obviously believes what she believes. And I happen to think what she believes is wrong most of the time. But she sticks with it. And she even sticks with it at the expense of her district's interests. Chasing Amazon out of that district was not necessarily a good economic move. It's a question as to whether it was even a good political move.
Absolutely. I think it's been forgotten by a lot of people. It was there and it was a big story and it seems to have gone off the radar screen. So is she the one that's going to inherit the mantle from Bernie Sanders? And is the progressive movement really strong? Is it changing the dynamic for the worker?
I don't think it's terribly strong at the moment. I think, in fact, if anything, it's probably weakening. And we're seeing chinks in the armor, so to speak. Whereas, look, I mean, the margin of majority that the Democrats have in the House has narrowed. So there was Biden apparently had no coattail effects. He basically they lost members of the House, so they have a razor thin majority in the House. They have a 50-50 breakdown in the Senate, so they were supposed to win a whole number of seats in the Senate, which would give them an absolute majority. That never happened. I think at this point, the more they push this agenda, which is very partisan, the end result will be that they will most likely lose their majority in the House in 2022, and a good chance they could lose the 50 votes they have in the Senate. That doesn't strike me as a great win for the progressive movement. The progressive movement, again, they're very ideological. And it's like, we don't want to compromise. We can't compromise. But, you know, the way you win an election and the way you win, you stay in power, is by compromising. And you win an agenda to a certain extent by compromising on that. In other words, you know, Joe Biden, for whatever his faults are, or whatever his good traits are, he is of the old school where, you know, you worked across the aisle with your opposing party to get something done. And if you did, and you basically sacrifice a lot of your ideology in order to accomplish some results. And that's what Congress used to be, you know, in the 70s, the 80s, even into the 90s. But we've lost that.
So where do we go with this reality? Is there any way for the poor to ever become engaged in the political structure? Or are they too busy trying to survive? And what about people in the middle class? Are we voting enough in order to change these dynamics, or we're just not engaged? How is it that so many people are going to become elected because they get funding from people who are wealthier, and somehow they win, but their population of the very powerful isn't so great, is it? So do they, in a sense, buy votes by spending money?
Well, that's a model that's out there. It's certainly Anthony Downs' model that you buy votes by offering programs to people who benefit from those programs. And you're buying votes from the wealthy by pursuing their policy agenda. You're buying votes from the poor by giving them programs that increase their money utility. Now, you know, we should understand that the interests of the middle class are not necessarily the interests of the poor. And the poor generally often don't vote or don't participate at all because they don't feel the system is very responsive to their interests or their concerns. And, you know, voting studies do show this is true. And studies of Congress show this tends to be the case, that members of Congress are not responsive to people who are poor. They're not even responsive to the middle class anymore. They tend to only be responsive to those who are moneyed, who can make large contributions to their campaigns. It's we could assume, however, that if we supported more middle class policies, that the poor will derive benefit from those policies. I don't want to, you know, give this victory to Trump and say his economic policies had a benefit for poor people, though some will argue that the free market policies that allowed the economy to run and basically unchained it to a certain extent in the early days of his presidency did allow for people to derive benefit across the board. It's questionable whether policies with more regulations are going to allow that to continue. The policies that were put in place to deal with the pandemic have certainly hurt the poor and many in the middle class more so than people want to acknowledge.
And is there any hope that, for example, the labor movement is going to be able to wrestle some control and also increase the salaries of the poor as well as the middle class? Or are they just neutered somehow?
So, I mean, there are a couple ways to look at the labor movement, and not all are necessarily flattering to the labor movement. If you have a strong labor movement as a constituency, then you are more likely to be able to get policies that even benefit the poor legislated. They will support the policies like an increase in the minimum wage. But it's questionable as to whether they're supporting the increase in the minimum wage because they really want the wages of the poor to rise, or whether they're supporting those increases because if employers have to pay workers a higher minimum, they'll be more inclined to choose skilled workers over non-skilled workers, and the skilled workers tend to be unionized. So it'll be a benefit to union members. That's also an argument that's been made many times, particularly in the neoclassical economics literature. So, I mean, there's many ways to look at that issue. Needless to say, if you do increase the wages of those at the bottom, even if it's through a floor, it will have a ripple effect throughout the distribution, and the wages of those in the middle, including those who are members of unions, will also increase as well.
So if we increase incrementally, maybe so to avoid a shock to the system, where salaries are going to rise to $15 an hour, I don't know, in 3 years or 4 years, 5 years, whatever the case is, can we hold out that long? And is it that difficult to pay people $15 an hour? Will it also cause the prices of food and clothing to go up in order to cover these costs?
So again, it's one of these catch-22s. So you say, well, we don't have a shock to the system, so we're going to do it in steps, stages. By the time you legislate the final step, the $15 an hour will be worthless because of the value of the dollar will have decreased, particularly with inflation.
Right.
So now, the argument that's being made by those who want to tout the neoclassical model is basically this. If you raise the minimum wage over and above a market clearing wage, there will be lower employment. Okay, theoretically, that is true. But the question is, what's a market clearing wage? A market clearing wage could be what we would refer to as the median wage right now. The median wage is most likely $21, maybe $22 an hour. So if you have a minimum wage, even at $15 an hour, that's still less than your median wage of $21 or $22 an hour. It's not going to have great impact on employment rates. The other issue is, and then this is where the neoclassical model fails to make a distinction, is it doesn't distinguish between a disemployment effect, where employers actually fire workers in response to a wage increase, and they're not hiring future workers in the future. In other words, they're not creating jobs. Either way, you'll have lower employment. But there's a difference between the two. So while people are, while critics of the minimum wage are focused on this new, Congressional Budget Office report, which says, well, an increase in the minimum wage to $50 an hour is going to cost 1-point-something million workers of jobs, that's not clear what exactly that means. I haven't seen the report, but if it's similar to what the 2014 CBO report had to say, then basically it's more nuanced than the headlines are letting on. So in other words, what you're going to see is the following. They acknowledge that a larger swath of the labor market will get an increase in their wages, certainly more than are earning the statutory minimum wage, which would again suggest we're really talking about the effect of minimum wage population, in other words, the larger low-wage labor market. In other words, they are tacitly acknowledging ripple effects, or what I've called wage contour effects. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, then, what they're not distinguishing between future jobs not being created and actually workers being laid off. In most cases, what they really mean is you have lower employment because fewer jobs will be created in the future, not because workers who are all currently employed will necessarily be fired. Now, the other part of that is when you increase the minimum wage, or any wages for that matter, what you do is you have a supply side effect. More workers flood into the labor market in pursuit of that higher wage. So now you have more workers chasing fewer jobs, which also has the effect of creating a lower employment rate.
Wow, that's amazing. Does the deleterious effect of COVID-19, because so many people have died from it, does that also affect the wage distribution?
There, it's hard to tell what the impact is going to be. If you have fewer workers willing to come into the labor market because they're fearful of contracting the virus, then that should have an upward pressure on wages anyway. And fewer workers means you have a hard time attracting workers into the labor market.
Yes.
So then employers want to increase their wages. On the other hand, what we're being told by, again, critics of this bill is if you increase the unemployment benefit to a rate that's higher, effectively higher, than the wages they were earning, then they have little incentive to go back to work. I'm not sure how much, to what extent they would be called back to work if their employers can only operate at, say, 30 to 40% capacity.
Right. Very, very true. What will be the impetus to change the equation? Is it going to be overnight, or is this going to take 10 years? Assuming that we want to go there.
It's not going to happen overnight. You'd have to have a crisis driving that. So you'd have to have millions and millions of people in the street starving without a place, without a roof over their head in order to have that kind of revolution. But you don't have that.
But aren't we very close to it? How many more stimulus bills can be approved? not because they cannot or will not be approved, but just how many more do we need? Evictions will eventually start, whether it be in the middle of this coming year or maybe toward the end of the year. But, you know, $1,400 is not going to, it may pay the bills for some food, but it's certainly not going to pay for your arrears in rent. So are we doing the right things or are we just off key here?
I don't think this COVID relief bill is necessarily the right approach. I think a lot of economists would probably say the same thing, although I suppose in the short term, pumping more money into the economy will be good for the market, but to a certain extent, it has a negative impact in terms of interest rates and whatnot and causes inflation. Mm-hmm. It's not going to, the markets will respond negatively as well. So, but I think a better approach would have been, as I've suggested in the past, you know, compensate workers for their full loss and compensate small business for their full loss, but mm-hmm. don't necessarily give money away to people who have not suffered any loss of income. That makes really little sense.
Right. But that, in a sense, is buying the quiescence of people who don't necessarily need it so much, but they get it anyway, and so they're happy. So is it impossible for our government to be able to figure out who does and who does not need this stimulus?
Yeah.
We're sending Bill Gates, you know, $1,400 and his wife and so on and so forth.
Well, but let's say we're not sending that to, let's say, that they found a way to file a tax return, in which case their income is no more than $75,000 apiece. Basically it takes a lot of work because now you have to have the IRS go through and figure out who gets it, who doesn't get it based on past tax returns.
Gotcha.
That's the issue. It's much easier to do it this way. Now the problem, and you're basing it not even on last year's tax return, which is probably more, you would hope there's a basing on last year's return as opposed to 2019 mm-hmm. return, which is what they did for the first stimulus check, which really didn't make a whole lot of sense then either.
Is it conceivable that some major company will decide to increase the minimum wage even incrementally over time? Let's say a McDonald's did that. Can that change the landscape to raise the capacity of people at the poorest end of the socioeconomic ladder?
We've seen some of that in the past where bigger companies like Costco and Walmart mm-hmm. and a few others decide they're going to raise their, even Amazon, we're going to raise their minimum wages largely in response to pressure mounting in the halls of Congress. They're fearful of an increase in minimum wage being legislated, so they raise it mm-hmm. on their own. So you could say, well, okay, this is enlightened self-interest, but it's also what we call a efficiency wage, where people figure if they increase the wages of the workers, they'll get better output from the workers, their productivity rises, and ultimately the efficiency of the organization increases.
Mm-hmm. And so isn't even the incentive of $15 an hour at Amazon, isn't that just a stopgap and it benefits Amazon? Can they not pay more? Wouldn't that drive the equation forward? And does that undermine any return to the company? Do they lose anything by paying more, especially if they think they're getting increased productivity?
I doubt that they lose a whole lot by paying their workers more. Maybe some of the shareholders will lose a couple dollars in terms of their dividend checks, mm-hmm. but not that much. But, you know, I think the goodwill that you get among employees, and basically you're seeing what's going on right now is Amazon is basically thwarting efforts to unionize their operations. So they're here you have, you know, Jeff Bezos, who's supposedly the great progressive, but not when it comes to his own workers. Amazon mistreats their workers. They have abysmal track record with regards to how they treat their workers and work conditions of their operations. So it's not a very good picture. And quite frankly, they track their workers in terms of delivery. So, I mean, you know, if you're ever on the street or trying to drive and you're passing, you can easily be taken out by an Amazon truck that's not paying attention to traffic rules because they're trying to get that delivery in a specified period of time.
Yes. It's so there is no capacity for the labor to get involved. Are they just aware or they're not aware? Is that something that just doesn't make sense? They should have been so powerful. There's so many voters. They have money. Why can't they make an impact and change the equation?
I think they could make an impact if they actually had their priorities straight. I'm not sure they do anymore. Again, the purpose of the union should be to bolster their workers' pay. And basically, the argument they should be making is it's for the benefit of the middle class. What you're seeing now is they are losing the war. In terms of public opinion, you can see this with the teachers' unions and across the country right now. Nobody's if this is the impact of a union, you're going to keep the schools closed when the so-called science says it's safe to reopen them, then we don't believe that you really care about anything but yourself. So you know they need to have a better public relations game. You know they could. At least in the private sector, they could say, look, workers who are paid better deliver our better workers. They will be more pleasant to deal with at the retail level, and the impact on the public will also improve. Also, those of you who are not members of the union, the impact most likely will have ripple effects, in which case your wages go up too. The reality is wages have been stagnant for four decades now, in large part because there's been a death of labor market institutions like unions, like the minimum wage. They've also been stagnant because large corporations have created labor monopolies, which have effectively exerted downward pressure on wages, particularly at the bottom of the scale. And they've also been stagnant because of rising health care costs.
And is there any legislation that can be imposed from the government to change this equation? Or are elected officials just too scared to do that?
And it's like, well, you have a certain capital is a finite commodity. If you use it up for a particular piece of legislation, like your $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill, then you would have less capital to push for other programs, which could even be more beneficial in the long term.
Well, do we have socioeconomic researchers within the government? Just doesn't seem so, or at least maybe it's so subtle I just don't recognize it at all. You probably do, because you know you could smell it, whereas I can't. So, is there a role for government to change all of this equation?
There's a role for government to play in facilitating change and facilitating improvements. But you know there
they
has
don't
to
have
be
the
support.
Right?
There has to be support. There has to be support for those improvements and the support for those programs. Do you have socioeconomic researchers in the government? Yeah, you have plenty of them, but they basically are hired by people with a specific agenda, and they do what they're told.
That seems to be the equation everywhere. Is that the dynamic? That's the human dynamic, right? You do whatever the boss tells you to do, you keep your mouth shut, and that's how it works in government as well. So that doesn't seem to change. I never thought that in the past, but evidently that's the reality. So where do we go from here? Can we change the equation? Are we going to have an opportunity to change things around so that it balances out much better?
We could probably change it if we could have a more honest discourse about the impact of various policies on the middle class, and that really should mm-hmm. be our starting point. If you talk the language of the middle class, which means you're really targeting within universalism, then basically you build a broader consensus support for the programs that you would like to enact. If you simply focus on the extremes, those who are poor, you lose a lot of support, particularly among the middle class that happens to be left. But they're going to say, look, we're being squeezed, and you expect us to pay higher taxes to benefit other people, but we're being squeezed. We can't see it. Now, if you focus on a policy approach which can raise the wages of everybody, and in which case but those at the bottom will also derive benefit, even though they weren't specifically targeted for it, I think that's a broader appeal.
And what about the higher end of the market, the big business owners and very accomplished bankers and so on and so forth, and lawyers and all these people that are doing quite well? And do they have a role to play, or are they just not willing to do so? Are they paying higher taxes, or are they able to write it off because some clause in the tax law allows them to?
They are certainly willing to pay a higher marginal tax rate with the knowledge that they can not pay a higher effective tax rate because they have more deductions. That's been the case for a long time. I think that if we could alter the tax code, which is basically a tough road to travel, if mm-hmm. we could basically change the tax code in such a way that we simply had no deductions, but we had relatively low tax rate. We had several of them, so we'd have some measure of progressivity in built into the tax code. It would be much more efficient. Most economists will say that if you'd had that, that would definitely be a more efficient tax code than what we currently have. If you want to have deductions for mortgage interest, you're going to have to pay for it a higher tax rate. If you want to have a deduction for charitable contributions, you're going to pay for it with higher tax rates. If you want to have a deduction for depreciation on your business, we're all going to pay for it in terms of a higher tax rate. There's no such thing as a free lunch here. Basically, this has been the basis upon which members of Congress from both parties have built support for their particular programs, their policies. They basically have developed their own constituents by promising different groups benefits they could derive through the tax code, but the effect has been to raise the cost for everybody. It's what a somewhat famous political scientist named Theodore Lowy calls distributive politics, whereby everybody derives a benefit, everybody also pays the cost. And basically, the budget is never cut. You can never cut it once you increase the cost.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And but is the dogma that's being represented by the different parties that are out there, is it working, or who's it working for?
Again, it's hard to say if it's working. Obviously, it didn't work in 2016. We got Trump. Because the Democrats and the progressives were not paying attention to middle-class voters who were suffering, particularly blue-collar workers who at one time were making a decent living in manufacturing. The manufacturing industry disappeared. They lost their jobs, and nothing came to replace them, paying the wage they were accustomed to. So he basically mounted a campaign where he basically was attuned to what they were saying, although he didn't do much to deliver on much of his promises. But it worked for him. It worked for basically the idea of focusing on a narrative of identity politics did not work in 2016. It only worked in 2020, the old model of identity politics, because people were so disgusted with Trump. I mean, it had nothing to do with any love for Biden. I'm not even sure what Biden represents. What does he stand for? I mean, you hardly see him. It's a classic case of delegating power and authority to people in the administration. But he's not there. I mean, he's almost like an empty suit at this point. But nobody voted for Biden because they truly love Biden. They voted for Biden because they can't stand Trump, which tells us that the issues that propelled Trump to victory, as narrow as it was in 2016, have not gone away. They're still there, and if we think for a minute that we can go back to the way things were, I think we're sadly mistaken.
I think you mentioned it as well. There will be a pushback in 2 years and probably in 4 as well. So, and especially if there's more responsibility to Kamala Harris, the vice president, and we see less and less of Biden. So that's going to become an issue as well. Amazing where and how we got here. So is there any hope to engage the people at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder? Or are they just silent and too busy and uninvolved because they don't have the time to get involved? And they don't have the money to send, to support.
They certainly don't have the money. Historically, they've not been involved. Voting studies going back 50, 60 years show that the poor are less likely to participate in political affairs, and they're less likely to vote. And the reason for that is the enemy is because they don't think the system has been responsive to their needs. So they could vote for the guy promising them programs, knowing full well the programs will never materialize and their plight will not change. They'll still be poor. They understand that full well. So that's a given. The only way that you can get them involved, I suppose, is if you have a serious policy which will raise their wages so they can become members of the middle class. I mean, I have found, looking at the issue of civic participation, that as you go from below $30,000 a year in household income to above $30,000, even $30,000 to $60,000, the rate of participation increases quite substantially among groups in terms of civic participation, in terms of willingness to go to PTA meetings and participate in other communal affairs, certainly the willingness to even vote. The income level does determine the extent to which you will participate in communal affairs. And again, that's important. If you want to get people involved, you really need to raise people's income. The question I think we have to ask is, do we really want them to be involved?
Yeah,
or are we just paying lip service?
It seems we're stuck, aren't we? Or maybe we're not stuck. This is maybe where we want to be. Rather than being stuck, we don't have an interest to evolve this thing to a better place. And is that part of our racism? Is it based on that, or is it based on something else? Is it just based on we need people at the lower end, we need them to be subservient to our system, and then we have people in the middle class, whether it's a lot or less, it doesn't matter. And then we've got the wealthy. So do we know what we want yet? We may individually, but we don't have a collective, maypole to dance around.
Well, I mean, the people at the top definitely want to maintain their positions of power, so they don't want to change anything. They like the status quo as it is.
Right.
If you can deflect criticism, divert attention by focusing on a particular narrative, if the narrative today happens to be what you want to call systemic racism, and I'm not entirely sure what that means. There was a term we used to use in the 60s and 70s called structural racism, but I think they mean something that's larger than structural racism. Structural racism was like, well, you weren't going to give loans to people in certain neighborhoods because you assume, because they are living in those neighborhoods, they obviously must be among the people who can't pay it back. That was classic structural racism. Now, is that systemic racism? Will you specifically say, I will not give a loan to black people? I think that would be the definition of systemic racism, but I'm not entirely sure what they mean by that. But I think it has become a convenient narrative for people who really don't want to change the status quo to basically divert attention to say, well, your problems are because of racism. It's nothing to do with the labor market. It has nothing to do with our wanting to maintain our profits for ourselves.
Right. So it looks like this is where we're going to be, doesn't it? In the near future, it doesn't look like there will be any change to this reality. And does that serve anybody? Because there seems to be a simmering strife all along the different strata, isn't it?
Each group on top definitely needs to maintain a group below them in order for them to retain their positions of superiority, dominance, whatever you want to call it. You know, Marx basically said you need a group to exploit. Whomever that group happens to be. Well, we no longer exploit the factory workers because we no longer have an industrial economy. We have a service, a post-industrial service-based economy, whereby low-wage workers are basically in the services. These are your retail workers. These are your convenience store workers. These are the big, box store workers. And they are definitely low-wage, low-skilled workers.
Yeah.
We need them to stay that way so people who are earning a few steps above them can also feel that they are somebody.
Mm-hmm. And what about the cost? If the poor, who maybe like migrant workers, they're working in the fields of New York, picking oranges or picking grapes or some other fruit that comes from a tree or a vine, they're not earning even maybe $7 an hour. They live in appalling conditions. They can't get involved, can they? They're working and sleeping and eating whatever little they have. Is there no interest to have these things change?
Well, they can't get involved if they're undocumented because they're not allowed to vote anyway. And they're certainly reluctant to get involved if they're undocumented for fear that they will be deported. So but aside from that, if they are here for a better life, they came here presumably to attempt to make a living, they probably couldn't care less about being involved in American politics.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So where do we go from here? We're in the middle of a muddle, so to speak. You know, it's hard to know where we're going. Do we know where we're going? Do you see that on the horizon anywhere, or is that still too murky to figure out? I don't see any change.
It's not entirely clear where we're going. I think it's worth pointing out that we have a reality, we have a model that's out there, but the model is not going to work. But I think the larger point was that rising income inequality is a larger threat to democratic governance than a lot of people have thought about.
And do we have any politicians that are espousing a reality based on what's already on the landscape as opposed to just bromides?
Well, politicians are very good at giving us bromides, and various canards. They feel that will basically secure their support for them politically, but they're not offering us anything tangible, any way to deal with some of these issues. Again, here's the problem: if you say, let's tax the wealthy to deal with rising income inequality, so the effect will be their after-tax income is decreased. So the ratio between the after-tax income of the poor, who basically don't pay taxes because their income falls below a certain threshold, and the people and those at the top, the ratio has diminished. So you say, income inequality has declined. Now, the argument for raising taxes on the wealthy is to finance programs that will benefit the poor. But there's no guarantee that once you've increased taxes on the wealthy, that they will filter down to the poor in the form of benefits. That often does not happen, contrary to the rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And a lot of poor have no reason to believe it's going to happen. So it's basically a nice little tale that's being told. But you haven't but what you have done, at least for the Blasios and the AOCs of the world, is you've punished the wealthy to a certain extent by enabling them to purchase fewer items in conspicuous consumption because their after-tax income has decreased. But you haven't really solved the problem of rising income inequality. Oh yeah, your ratio has decreased, but you really haven't done anything to raise the incomes of those at the bottom, which would be of greater benefit. Right.
Is there a fear by politicians to somehow benefit the middle class by raising wages at the lower end?
I think what the politicians are responding to is, so there's another way to look at this, to say, the argument against the rate increase in minimum wage, which is offered by the neoclassical crew, is that it basically benefits people who are non-poor. Why is that? Well, if you say the teenager who is working for extra money gets a pay increase, even if fewer teenagers will be hired, they're non-poor, so they don't really need it. But if you follow the argument I've been making for several years now, the wage contour effects, that it could be benefit to the middle class, then that's also acknowledgement is not necessarily helping the poor. I'm suggesting it can help the poor, but I'm not saying the poor is my main concern. My main concern is the middle class.
Right.
But they're going to say, see, that you really don't care about the poor. But you just heard you're helping the middle class. Well, if it benefits the middle class, then the argument is going to be, then why do we need to do this at all? Why raise the minimum wage at all if it's going to benefit the middle class? Because we don't want wages to stagnate. That's why we do this. So this is the sort of tug of war. The issue for employers, however, is, well, if it's really a benefit to the middle class and not necessarily the poor, raising minimum wage is going to raise wages across the board. That's their concern, and that's what small businesses are really concerned about. They're not concerned about paying, a person at the bottom a few $3 more per hour. It's not going to hurt them that much. They're concerned about paying everybody who's earning wages above them more. And they don't come out and say it, but that's really their concern. A few of them have basically let the cat out of the bag when interviewed in terms of in connection with small business chambers of commerce, that kind of thing.
So in reality, are you familiar with anyone on the political landscape who is espousing that we do increase salaries for the middle class? Or is that just no longer in vogue? We only talk about the poor, and we talk about the rich. We talk about the poor, but we can't afford to give them an increase, and we're looking to tax the wealthy much more.
Everybody talks about increasing the wages of the middle class, but they talk about it within the context of improving market conditions. So if the market improves and productivity increases, then wages for everybody will increase. That's what they say. But we haven't quite seen that completely.
No. Unbelievable. Well, Professor, I'm captivated, as I always am. just brilliant, brilliant dissertation in this essay. I hope that people will read it. Thank you very much. Have a good Yontif, and all the best.
Thank you.
All the best. Thank you very much. Stay healthy and stay safe. Thank you, Professor. Okay, well, let's. We have a little bit of time. We can find out what's going on in our neck of the woods with respect to the professor. So just bear with me a moment as I pull up some information about that. And bear with me a second here. Okay, where are we? Here we are. I want to tell you about so many of the books that he's written, which I think you'll find very compelling if you have the time to read them. One of the books is Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage Policy. This book speaks to the arguments for a middle class. It's published by Palgrave, and then Palgrave. Another book, of course, is Understanding Public Policy in the United States, again, by Orrin Levin-Waldman, and this is published by Top Hat, T-O-P-H-A-T. Well, I got introduced to the professor when I read the book, The Minimum Wage, a reference handbook, issued and published by ABC-CLIO, C-L-I-O. So ABC-CLIO, it's an ABC affiliate, and just brilliant work. Kate captivated me when I read that. And then The Case of the Minimum Wage, Competing Policy Models, fascinating work, published by Routledge, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E. And then you have The Case of the Minimum Wage, Competing Policy Models. And this was published by the State University of New York Press, or SUNY Press, S-U-N-Y-P-R-E-S-S. And those are the works that he's completed. And then, just as a biography again, if you're not familiar, he is a faculty member in the School of Public Affairs and Administration at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey, and socioeconomic research scholar at Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity Research. You could find much more about him on his own website, Labor Econ, but the website address is Econ Labor. So www.econlabor.com. So econlabor.com. And if you want, on our website, you have his email address, so you can address him as well. That's listed there. Look up just Orrin, O-R-E-N. His last name is Levin Waldman, L-E-V-N hyphen W-A-L-D. M-A-N, so Orrin, M is his middle initial, Orrin M. Levin, hyphen Waldman. And I hope you enjoyed this discussion. I've always found him to be fascinating, just a brilliant thinker. And he's so familiar with the models of financial models that explain so much of what goes on. So he's got a sense of complexity that most of us don't have. So not only does he understand it conceptually, he understands it from a basic knowledge base of information because he's learned all the different brilliant minds that are out there. Some have points of and perspectives that are congruent to one another, and others that are not. But he's so well-versed in all of them that it's absolutely a brilliant, brilliant discussion. And unfortunately, somehow or another, I feel that as a society, we're not paying attention to people like him, specifically because maybe they scare us for some reason. He doesn't scare me, but I do remember the first time I was saying to myself, well, I'm quite secure about my intellectual capacity, but after first speaking to him and reading his books, I said, I don't know if I can handle this. And there are probably many times when we've discussed things with him where I'm not. But he's very fluid and he's very gentle about that. And the more that he was willing to engage us, for me personally, as well as our listeners, I think that we've all gained and attained a greater understanding of the complexity of the economic models that he presents to us. So it's more visible to us than it was ever before. And it's just brilliant, brilliant work. So I'm very thankful for his input, because it's just not attainable anywhere. And when you read the dogma that's spelled out by so many people in the socioeconomic world, they're not as accommodating of the less learned than I think Professor Oren M. Levin Waldman is. So that's the reality here. Bear with me a moment. I'm going to move on to some other issues. And it's about 11:06 here on the Eastern Seaboard. Now, let me just quickly look and see. Oh, yeah. What I wanted to do. Bear with me a moment. Okay. What I wanted to do is first cover some domestic issues with you. Well, the first is really something that came about, and it's an editorial that I wrote, and the title is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer Secures $360 billion in federal funding for state and local fiscal relief. And this editorial is called the Formula Editorial, posted very early, very literally, at 12:01 in the morning. So it reads as follows. The numbers reveal the value of this largesse will have on communities and the people who reside within those boundaries. I'm talking about the $360 billion. Well, in the city of Buffalo is going to get $350 million. Mount Vernon, $42.5 million. New Rochelle, $36 million. Rochester, shy of $207 million. Syracuse, $126 million. Utica, $64 million. White Plains, $22 million. Yonkers, $89 million. So can you see the pain the numbers will exact? But Senator Schumer is slick enough to gloss over the numbers, explaining that New York's metropolitan cities will get $6.14 billion. Counties will receive $3.9 billion. And smaller cities, towns, and villages will receive $825 million. Well, New York State will also receive $358 million from the state and local fund for building out broadband infrastructure. It is estimated that New York State's agencies and authorities will receive over $30 billion from the American Rescue Plan. On top of the funds from the state and local fiscal relief fund. In a background of these large numbers, remember that Yonkers will still only receive $89 million. It seems that Senate Majority Leader Schumer has learned to admonish and chastise the city of Yonkers in the same dismissive manner as have other elected officials who would have hoped would, after my 21 years on the Yonkers city streets, found a way to restructure the so-called formula that forces Yonkers to get so much less per population than the other four of the big five school districts, of which Yonkers, of course, is one. Has the city of Yonkers squandered its credibility in such a manner that we suffer financially for, at minimum, over two decades? Perhaps New York State doesn't trust us. What have we done to be dismissed without even a sorry? Yet Yonkers has not been singled out completely. Boston is suffering the same plight. Portchester, too. Even Utica. Question is why? Have all the communities mentioned done something wrong? I don't think so. Perhaps our elected officials have been the ones to do something wrong. When will they figure it out? When will we figure out that they are not serving us well? And will we say enough is enough? And when will we say enough is enough? When will we vote for people who will deliver on their promises during the election season? And when will we kick them out the door by casting our vote for another seemingly credible candidate who claims they can deliver? Will we maintain our vigilance when they fail? And will we praise and thank them when they succeed? Your vote matters. Our elected officials need to learn that you won't take it anymore. It is their job to bring home the bacon. They can take the bus to Albany. We need not go with them to hold their hand while they are trying to bring out the issue that Yonkers and other communities in Westchester County are not getting a fair share of the money allocated to New York State. Let us not forget that one sum is sent to the state of New York. The hackneyed formula is instituted in Albany, and that is how we get less than our fair share. Austin can do so as well, Utica too, also Portchester. I think the elected officials need to create one formula that is equal in percentage-wise in every manner. In other words, the funds allocated by the federal government must be designated by a formula, such as the last census. Then the state would divide the percentage of the funds at hand among all the communities. They will each get the same percentage as does every community. So Austin and Bronxville and New Rochelle and Utica, and yes, even Yonkers, would get the same percentage cut of the funds the federal government has returned to the state. Thereafter, it becomes the responsibility of every community to spend the funds wisely, simple and clear and doable. So when will Senate Leader Schumer get it? Should have gotten it before he succumbed to the formula that has maligned the capacity of one community after the other. So perhaps I should lighten up a bit with all due respect so that Senator Schumer can figure out what formula, quote unquote, he will institute so that every community has an equal opportunity to succeed. 2022 is not that far off. Perhaps the senator should realize he is up for re-election every 2 years. He can mess up budgets for just so long. The public is wiser than ever. And please note, village and town governments will be receiving a direct allocation of federal assistance as intended by the legislation. But village amounts are not included in the breakdown because of the complication of calculating those amounts until a process is put in place to divvy up funds between overlapping governments. Town amount listed in the breakdown does capture the village amount. As the town dollar amount reflects the entire population of the town, which will include the village or the villages. Identification of eligible governments and distribution of assistance across units with overlapping populations will be decided by the Department of Treasury in its implementation. And that's so logical. Yet when one looks at the bigger picture, it is maligned. It doesn't serve the community. Since that is a known fact, who does it serve? If so, why are they permitted to gain access to funds relegated for governments to serve their constituents? Phew, that doesn't seem so bad now, does it? Well, Schumer goes on to say, eligible uses of funds by state and local governments, costs associated with responding to the COVID-19 public health emergency or its negative economic impacts, including but not limited to assistance to households, small businesses, nonprofits, or aid to impacted industries such as tourism, travel, and hospitality. Continuing, he says, to support workers performing essential work during the COVID-19 public health emergency by providing premium pay to eligible workers or by providing grants to eligible employers that have eligible workers who perform essential work. To cover revenue losses caused by the COVID-19 public health emergency, to make necessary investments in water, sewer, or broadband infrastructure. Funds may not be used by states or localities to cover the cost of pension funds. States may not use funds to offer a reduction in taxes. Sounds good, doesn't it? Yet everyone knows that pension funds get padded year after year. Who's watching the hen house? Where have they been? And who, pray, will make sure no hanky-panky is taking place? Perhaps no one. I think so. Why? I don't know. And why did Mr. Schumer's office not send us the report divulged herein yesterday publicly? Does he want Yonkersites to know the real deal? It proves one thing. Yonkers is suffering its plight from without and within. Yet I have not heard the rationale for this conduct. Have you? If so, please enlighten me. The takeaway is redundant but unexplained. Why? It looks like even the Feds use a formula that screws Yonkers as opposed to Buffalo, Rochester, and Syracuse. Yonkers gets less than half of what Syracuse and Rochester get, and only slightly more than a quarter of what Buffalo gets. Based on all these facts, I wonder how and who came up with this deleterious formula. Shame on them for formulating it, and shame on Yonkersites for tolerating this outrageous reality. So that's the story. Well, let me just quickly go back to our studio screen. Bear with me a second. Okay. Very good. Well, we're so overwhelmed with work, so backlogged. I'm not going to continue in order to be able to get to the work that's on hand. We have a lot of things to write up and follow up through. I read that article again. I wrote that very, very late last night, totally exhausted, and then kept on going for another 2 hours into the morning. So the bottom line is I see that there were spelling errors, and I want to go and correct that as well. So that's our story. Let's see, tomorrow's Thursday. Just to tell you who's going to be on with us tomorrow, bear with me a second. Let's see. Okay, tomorrow we're going to be speaking to John and Lori Wiles. And then Brian Harrod and I will engage in a discussion on the latest news from 10:30 to 11:30. And then Jose Alvarado will be speaking to us the last half hour. He is the Westchester County Legislative District Representative to District 17. So we'll talk to him and we'll see what goes on there. So that seems to be our story. Bear with me a moment to get back to our studio screen again. Here we are. It's about 11:15, 11:17 or so. We're going to say goodbye, and we thank you again for being with us. What a pleasure, and goodbye.